science you can use. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium. And iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium.
Well, welcome, everyone. Very special guest today, Dr. Jess Steyer. Jess is a PhD in public health, and she has a great podcast called Unbiased Science, which is the way that she came to my attention. As I lie sleepless in the middle of the night, as unfortunately much too often happens, despite experimenting with melatonin, with glycine, with THC, sometimes I just don't know what to do in the middle of the night. So I listen to podcasts and I hit upon Unbiased Science. And I was immediately intrigued because Jess deals with exactly the kind of issues that we often deal with here in terms of separating sense from nonsense. And it's always great to meet a kindred spirit. So Jess, thanks very much for coming on here. And maybe just to get started, give us a little bit about your background, how you got into podcasting.
Absolutely. And thank you so much, Dr. Schwartz, if I could call you Joe for the
purpose of this conversation.
Yes. Great. So as you said, you know, my background, my doctorate is in public health. Really, I'm a data scientist, but I'm also a public health generalist. So I have some training in epidemiology, in biostatistics. My passion and my main expertise is in health policy and program evaluation. So using data to really see, okay, did this program, did this policy do the things it was supposed to? You know, did it improve health outcomes and quality and drive down costs and all that good stuff? But then COVID hit, as we all are very well aware, in 2020, and I found that so many of my friends and family members had no clue how to make sense of science by headline and all the preprints being released to the public, really without proper context, and everyone was scared. And I was like, wow, what a good time to have a degree in public health. You know, I've trained for this. So I decided to formalize things into Unbiased Science. So yes, it's a podcast. It's also a social media page. So we deploy daily infographics that help take complex scientific matters and make them more digestible and accessible for folks who might not have extensive scientific training. And there's also a whole lot of debunking of misinformation and chemophobia and lots of the things that you do. So I'm really, really excited to chat with you today.
Well, it's Unbiased Science is a very clever title because, of course, it also implies that there is biased science out there, right? Which certainly is something that we all have to be aware of and battle, that not everything that is published in the even in the peer-reviewed literature should be taken as if it were written in stone. There are errors that are made. Unfortunately, there's fraud that is there. But I mean, still peer-reviewed work is still the best way to go. But Jess, let's talk about some of the things that, you know, we've both encountered and which are our current, you know, issues. You obviously have dealt with the anti-vaxxers, as we have. My feeling there is that it often ends up sort of hitting your head into the wall, that when you have the dedicated anti-vaxxers, there's not much you can do to change their mind. Is that something that you've also found?
Yeah, you know, it's tough because really the whole reason I'm doing this, I want to avoid the echo chambers, and I don't only want to speak with people who are already science-minded. You know, I want to speak to the skeptics, but as you said, that is no small feat, and it's very difficult to do that. And I do think, unfortunately, there is a segment of the population that is unreachable. You know, they've made up their minds, and even when presented with evidence and all the data, you know, till you're blue in the face, it's just not going to get through. And I think the majority of these people, there's just such a deep-seated distrust of government, and this idea that all the data we're showing them is, you know, it's somehow been manipulated to further some you know, pro-vax agenda. But that being said, I do still think that there's a segment of the population that can be reached. You know, they're skeptical. They, you know, they've heard all the anti-vax things. They've bought into a lot of that. But I know because, you know, I've received hundreds, if not thousands, of messages over these last 4 years that people have changed their minds and they've changed their perspectives, and that's been reflected in their decisions and behaviors. And many people have said, you know, I was never going to get the vaccine, but I read all of your content and I made the decision to go ahead and get it. So
right, there's definitely yeah, there's definitely a segment of the population that is legitimately confused, which is understandable because there's so much information coming at us from every angle, both proper information and misinformation and disinformation. They don't know whom to believe. And right. Those are the people who know that they are confused and are looking to be unconfused. Those are the people that we can reach. Whereas the dedicated followers of RFK Jr., I don't think are reachable because their mind is cemented shut. You know, they've made up their opinion that you know, vaccines were kind of formulated by the devil and are there to depopulate the world. And I think that those are the ones, as you said, which are not reachable. But so we got to aim at that segment of the public that wants to learn and that is willing to listen to arguments that are properly formulated and which are based on evidence. I mean, evidence, of course, is really what we look for. Anyway,
can I interject for one sec, Joe? Oh, I'm so sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think another interesting piece here is that a lot of people don't really understand the scientific process. And so they see what COVID did is it sort of lifted the curtain on a lot of that. And they're seeing a lot of back and forth communication, even among scientists, and that often, you know, occurs behind peer review, the peer review curtain. And now it's all playing out in public. You know, as the pandemic moved forward, obviously the virus evolved. Some of the messaging changed when the COVID vaccines, became less effective at preventing transmission. And of course, we know that was not the primary goal of the vaccines. But, you know, over time, that messaging changed. And so I think the public sometimes sees it as flip-flopping and that, oh, well, the science got it wrong. And no, the science did not get it wrong. That's not how science works. It's that we you know, things changed, our knowledge evolved, we learn new things. And so I think there's a lot of, you know, disconnect between what science actually is designed to do. And
absolutely.
Not do.
And people don't understand that flip-flopping is actually, you know, the essence of science. We learn new things and then we incorporate it into our philosophy and our advice. You know, I've gotten sort of comments from former students. And, they tell me, you know, I remember listening to you in class 30 years ago, which is already frightening, when you said, that vitamin E was useful in prevention of cardiovascular disease. And now you're telling us that it's useless. You see, you guys, you scientists, one day you say this and next day you say that. I get those kind of comments. And of course, I have to tell them that 30 years is not one day this, next day that. There's a lot that happens in 30 years. And what has happened is that we have had a lot of published information about vitamin E since that time. And what originally looked like, you know, there was some optimism there, it just disappeared when we did proper randomized controlled trials. And that's the way that things work. But just another way that things work is that this is a commercial radio station, so we got to take a break. We'll take a break, check what traffic is doing out there, and we'll be right back with Dr. Jess Steyer.
Life's everyday mysteries solved. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
We are back with Dr. Jess Steyer, who's a PhD in public health. And we're discussing or commiserating our concerns about people who may not be getting all the right information out there when it comes to making decisions. So, Jess, besides the vaccine issue, which of course was probably the dominant issue during COVID, but there were other issues that came up as well, nutritional issues, drug issues, you know, the hydroxychloroquine issue, the ivermectin issue, you know, which of course we have dealt with, a lot of misinformation and disinformation. And I like to distinguish between misinformation and disinformation. I don't know if you deal with that as well, where misinformation is just wrong information that may be unwillingly spread, whereas disinformation is information that is being spread with the full knowledge that it is wrong, usually for some sort of monetary gain. You come across that kind of conflict?
Oh, yes, all the time. Because as to your point, I think that there are people who share things that they don't realize are not factual, you know, are not evidence-based. And even though that is still quite damaging and frustrating, there's no, you know, intention to do harm or mislead. And yes, I mean, then you have the peddlers of disinformation, and I know there's the disinformation dozen. The Center for Countering Digital Hate, perhaps?
Right,
I can't remember who exactly coined that. But yes, I mean, there are these folks who they know better, and yet they do spread the disinformation, the false information. And, you know, it's difficult because then the public will say, well, why are they doing this? And the answer is not, I don't think, super straightforward. I think there are a lot of different reasons. Sometimes it's politically motivated. You know, you mentioned RFK and others. But also, there's a lot of money to be made on disinformation.
There sure is.
When people grow these platforms, you know, they're feeding into this skepticism, and they grow these platforms, and, you know, large platforms can often be monetized. And then, so you have the fortune, and then you also have the fame and the attention that people get when they are very loud about the disinformation that they're spreading.
Well, on all of those lists of disinformants, the name that is almost always number one is Joe Mercola, who's a former osteopathic physician who hasn't practiced for over 30 years, but has built a huge following of millions of people. When you talk about monetizing something, he sure has managed to do that. He's worth about $100 million, and he sells all kinds of supplements, most of which are nonsensical and not backed by evidence. And he has also gotten into politics recently. To me, he's the devil incarnate. Really, the disinformation that he spreads is absolutely frightening. He comes out with something virtually every day, and it's almost always wrong. Whatever dietary advice that he gives. But, you know, what happens is that very often there's a smidgen of truth, of fact, that he then blows totally out of proportion. I mean, his big bugaboo now is linoleic acid, which is a polyunsaturated fat that is found in many, many seeds and grains. He thinks that this is what is undermining the health of the world's population. It's total nonsense. But yes, you can find some studies that show that under certain conditions, linoleic acid is oxidized and becomes rancid. Mm-hmm. Big deal. It's not.
Oh, you mean confirmation bias, right?
Right.
If you're looking for it, you're going to find something, right? But then, people then will take preclinical studies or in vitro studies or very very small studies, and then it wildly extrapolate them, right? And claim that, oh look, there's this one study that found that, oh, linoleic acid causes X, Y, and Z. Sure. Or maybe, but it was done in, 12 rats when they were exposed to 5,000 times the level that we would ever be exposed to in reality, right?
Exactly. You can cherry pick data these days to prove almost anything that you want to prove because there's so much literature published. Some of it very good, some of it very bad, most of it mediocre. That's what the literature is all about. So you can find something to back up anything, and you can be very convincing. I tell you, I once did as a little experiment. I chose bisphenol A as a topic because it is one of the most controversial chemicals. It is used to make polycarbonate plastics, which are very widely made, but it is also an endocrine disruptor. And, endocrine disruptors these days are, get a lot of attention. Deservedly, there is an issue there. Anyway, so I put together two talks on bisphenol A, one from each side. And one of them sang its praises, what a great substance it is, and the other one was exactly the opposite. Both of them were based on published literature with proper references. And I made each one sound like it was, the ultimate research conclusion. Mm-hmm. Because you can do that these days. You can just pick your data and prove anything. Of course, what was left out is that one side of this argument is backed by massive amount of scientific literature, while the other one is not, and it's mostly speculative. But, it certainly is possible to convince people either way, especially when, people don't have much of a scientific background, which is mostly the case.
Right. And Joe, this is why I tell people till I'm blue in the face that the scientific consensus is so powerful, right? Because you'll never have total agreement on a particular topic for all the reasons that you just outlined. And that's why, I think, what is the body of evidence support? What are the majority of experts in a particular field? How do they feel? Because they're the ones who are best positioned to weigh in on these topics.
Absolutely. And, when you look at something like climate change, which is such a hot topic, you'll find papers published on either side of this argument, but not the same number of papers. And this is where, the consensus among climate scientists who really do research in this area, the atmospheric chemists and that ilk, there's universal agreement among them that carbon dioxide levels are increasing. Well, of course, nobody debates that. That's a fact. But there's universal agreement that it is because of human activity. But yes, you can have the odd outlier who will give a wonderful lecture. Generally, they're very good speakers, these outliers, who can, convince the public that all of this carbon dioxide business is nonsense and that, it is just distracting from other problems that we should be looking at. So, the massive amount of scientific literature makes life very confusing when you don't know how to select it and when you don't know how to look for consensus. Anyway, Jess, unfortunately, we've got to take another break and we'll chat some more about some very specific issues that we have both encountered. You're listening to the Dr. Joe Show. We'll check news and be right back.
It's all about chemistry. Science you can use. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
It's all about chemistry. Oh, 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 oh.
We're back with Dr. Jess Steyer. who's a public health expert, PhD in that discipline, but also has a great podcast called Unbiased Science. And we're chatting about some of the issues that we both have to confront. So just the other night, as I said, when I was listening, sometime at around 4:30, I came across one of your recent podcasts about microplastics and nanoplastics, which is something that we've, of course, dealt with extensively. And you had a couple of experts on there, and did a great job on that, presenting the problems as they are. And it is a very good example of how there are really two sides, and that sometimes it's very difficult to know exactly what recommendation to make. I mean, there's no question that nanoplastics and microplastics are real. They're there in our environment, and we have to confront them. But just because something is there doesn't mean that it's presenting a danger. So I really like the way that you guys handle that.
When you
basically presented, what the issues are, and then kind of, let the public come to conclusion based upon the evidence that was presented. So,
well,
yeah, nanoplastics.
Can I say one thing before you go into the...
Before I interrupt? Yeah.
Yes. No, stop it. I'm interrupting. But I was just going to say that I appreciate that feedback, because it's funny, some of the feedback that I received from the public on that episode is that they were frustrated that there was no clear answer. There was no, black and white solution. And as you said, we were acknowledging, yes, microplastics, nanoplastics, they're out there. And, we're breathing them, we're drinking them, we're eating them. And as you said, certainly we want to limit plastic for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is environmental impact. But we really just don't have a ton of evidence on what this is doing to our, to human health. And people were like, well, what do you mean we don't know? How do we not know? And I think that just speaks to this larger issue of why sometimes mis and disinformation and some of the claims put out by the wellness industry and others, why they're so successful, is because they offer those answers very clearly on a silver platter. They make sweeping statements, black and white statements, very absolutist. And that is a lot more palatable and, easy for the public to understand and to act upon. It gives them a sense of control. And so I think this episode, which, people left with questions, probably more questions than answers, and that didn't sit well with folks. So I thought that was sort of an interesting takeaway.
Right. I mean, as you said, some of those pseudo experts will whittle down the information and make it into a soundbite, and come up with a simple solution to a complex problem. And unfortunately, those are very rare, those simple solutions. And, nanoplastics is just, one of the examples of things that we have to deal with that we don't know enough about. And I always like to emphasize that just because we find the presence of something, that doesn't mean that it's risky. That's a whole other question that has to be addressed. And the microplastics issue is absolutely a fascinating one, in the sense that it was never predicted. When we first started talking about plastics, and of course I've been talking about it for a very long time, discussions always start with The Graduate, right? The great 1967 movie when Dustin Hoffman is corralled by a friend of the family, and he's thinking about what career to launch, and he whispers into his ear, plastics, right? Because in those days, plastics was the emerging industry. I mean, it was wonderful. We airplanes were made of plastics, cars made of plastics, we had plastic furniture, plastic houses, and plastic shoes and everything. People were enamored of plastics. No one at that time ever thought that these things in the environment would be, you know, buffeted about by waves in the air and whatever and break down and result in these invisible particles that can make their way into our body. No one would have ever predicted that. You know, there was no way to think about that. But now we have it. And whether it's doing something or not, we really don't know. Maybe they are inertly passing through our body. Although there's a lot of evidence that some of these nanoparticles are small enough to bypass, you know, the intestine and get into the bloodstream and maybe even, you know, deposit in coronary arteries. And that's, you know, a recent area. And you chatted about that on your program. So, you know, there are alarms about this. But the fact is that we just don't know. And very often in science, that's what we have to say. We don't know. And the quacks and the alternative medicine people never say that. They always have an answer to everything. They, you know, very often it's wrong, but they always have an answer. There was one thing that was very interesting that came up. I think you were talking about fish and how obviously fish can have nanoplastics because it's swimming about in the ocean where, you know, it's all of this invisible microplastics and gets into their body. But then one of your guests was talking about how once the fish are eviscerated and, you know, the digestive tract is removed and there's no nanoplastics left, right, in the flesh, mm-hmm. which is obviously mm-hmm. correct, right? But, you know, then it brings up another question. Yes, you eviscerate those fish and you have their guts or whatever with the microplastics. What happens to that? Where does it go? Because matter doesn't disappear.
Right.
And, right? So, yeah, so you gut all these fish and you make the flesh safe, right? But where do all those microplastics that you just gutted, where do they go? Do they eventually end up back in the water system or in our food in some other way? I mean, these are almost undecipherable things. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to convince the public that there's some things that we just don't know and we have to say we don't know, you know. And
exactly. It's also interesting when I hear people say we don't know, I take that as you know, that's a strength, because offering up answers that we don't yet have, I mean, that's when you're really misleading the public. And you know, it's funny that you bring up the fish, because I've seen this in so many viral social media clickbait posts. Oh, you know, the study found in the whatever, you know, that fish contain so-and-so amounts of microplastics, and so don't eat, and then they'll list the fish, or, you know, that you can't eat, or they'll suggest some alternative diet that cuts it. And it's like, you can't, I mean, for the reasons that you just brought up, it's not that simple, and it's this oversimplification, this you know, absolutist approach to information that we just really have to move away from, but it's so difficult to do, especially in the time of social media where everything is about, you know, grabbing someone's attention quickly. Like, that's the stuff that makes people pause, right? So that's what we're up against.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's the old story that dog bites man is not news, but man bites dog is.
Right.
So they'll constantly look for the unusual because that's what sells. You know, they look for the quick, the bait, the clickbait, and to come up with headlines that very often are not even, you know, appropriate to the content of the article, but they just want to catch the viewers. Anyway, we have a lot more to talk about, but we've got to take another break. We'll be right back after we check traffic. You're listening to the Dr. Joe Show.
Your source when you need answers. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
My guest today is Dr. Jess Steyer, who hosts a very, very interesting podcast called Unbiased Science. And like us, she looks at a science and tries to demystify it. She's a PhD in public health. So, Jess, you know, one thing that I find very interesting, that on one hand, many members of the public have developed a distrust of science, right? We've seen this since COVID. But on the other hand, they expect science to be able to answer almost every question that they have. So, you know, on one hand, they don't like what science is doing. But on the other hand, they respect science and think that, you know, we should be able to provide all of the answers. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of an interesting conundrum, I think. I mean, science can provide some answers, but it can't provide all the answers.
Exactly.
And so actually, what would you say?
I've noticed what I think is a somewhat disappointing trend among some science communicators. I mean, actual real scientists who, you know, they're realizing that the algorithm works against us when we try to bring in the nuance and the context and all the, you know, the important details that really matter. And some will take a bit of a more, you know, this is it, you know, like sort of handing up, just as the people who peddle misinformation and disinformation, sort of taking a more absolutist approach. And even something like vaccination, like, you know, you will not, vaccines do not cause, you know, X, Y, and Z, you know, some bad outcomes. And the reality is, right, I mean, vaccines very, very rarely lead to serious adverse effects. And of course, we know that. But they sometimes do. You know, it's a very rare event. And certainly the benefits outweigh the risks from a population perspective. But I think we have to watch ourselves and not sort of fall into those same traps that we've noticed, you know, the science, I don't know, to anti-science folks, the way that they approach communication. So it's sort of, it's difficult because we're fighting against what I'm calling, you know, the algorithm, and we want to get people's attention and we want to appear confident because that's what people want to see. But then we also have to recognize that that's just not how science works, and we can't make those all or none statements, you know?
Totally. And we always have to emphasize the risk-benefit ratio, because mm-hmm. everything that we do in life has some risk associated with it. It's always a question of the benefits. I mean, you know, going back to the plastics issue, certainly there are detriments, like the nanoplastics and the fact that people just use plastics when you really don't need to. I mean, we don't need the plastic straws, although, you know, that issue has been blown, I think, way more up, more than it deserves, just because something that was said to be a plastic straw was found in the nose of a turtle. But anyway, I mean, we can't have our life the way that we have it today without plastics. I mean, it's just impossible. You look at a hospital, you know, just look around, everything is basically plastic. So it's a question of risk versus benefit. And that's what we constantly have to emphasize. And you do that very well. Anyway, what are some of the other issues that you've been battling or encountering?
So an interesting one that comes up quite a bit, supplements. Well, I'll name a few, and then I know you've tackled all of these things, so I would love to talk about any that really stand out to you. But supplements are a big one, as well as this idea of natural versus synthetic, and how all natural things are, you know, better than anything made in a lab, and also organic versus conventional produce, and a lot of fear around pesticides. I'd say those are some very big themes I'm seeing in my messages right now.
Yeah, those are the very of course, those are the ones that we see. Also, I just wrote an article about the Dirty Dozen. The Environmental Working Group every year, of course, comes out with their list of fruits and vegetables that contain the highest levels of pesticides. And again, that has to be discussed in context. I mean, pesticides are not used frivolously, that they serve a purpose. And yes, there are residues, but the question is how much and whether or not those residues have been shown to be detrimental to people. And those are, you know, complex issues to deal with. But in science, we deal with those in terms of numbers. I mean, I always like to emphasize that numbers are the currency of science. And when the Environmental Working Group puts out a document listing the, quote, most dangerous fruits and vegetables because of pesticide residues, without ever mentioning a number of what you know, what residue, how much, and how it relates to the acceptable daily intake, then you know that we're just looking at a ploy here to raise money. That's basically what they do.
100%. And let's not even talk about just the concept of hazard versus risk and how, as you said, you know, anything can be hazardous, right? We know that the dose makes the poison. There's really not a substance on earth that at some level won't, you know, cause harm. But a risk-based approach takes into account, as you said, exposure. So yeah, I mean, finding trace amounts of pesticides is one thing, but the fact that they're there in such minuscule amounts that don't have any, or I shouldn't say don't have, but, you know, we don't typically see at levels that could even potentially impact human health in any significant or clinically relevant way. I mean, that is really missing from the conversation. It's just the mere presence of pesticides that's supposed to scare us. Of course, ignoring the fact that these pesticides allow us to have a robust food supply, and without which, you know, our farmers would have no crops, we would not have fruits and veggies on our grocery shelves. I mean, it's just such a myopic and misguided
pretty soon
way
there
of
will
approaching
be,
it.
Pretty yeah. soon there will be 10 billion people coming to dinner.
Right.
And the fact is, we are not going to feed them organically. That's not going to happen. You need the appropriate use of agrochemicals. And yes, appropriate is a word that we should be using.
Right.
And, you know, farmers are trained about, you know, how to manage these. And the bottom line is that the benefits outweigh the risks. Mm-hmm. Yes, it would be ideal if we could have all of the food that, you know, we want without ever using any synthetic fertilizer, without using pesticides. But that's not going to happen. We live in the real world. Anyway, mm-hmm. Jess, unfortunately, the real world tells me that our time is coming to an end, and I know that this hour has flown by. We'll have to do this again because, you know, we have so many things that we have sort of common views on, but mm-hmm. you know, it never hurts to emphasize and re-emphasize them from other people. So thanks a lot for coming on, and I'll urge people to listen to your podcast, which is Unbiased Science, which I'm sure, as they say, you can find anywhere where you find podcasts, right?
That's right. And thank you so, so much, Joe, for having me on. It was such a pleasure. And yes, I'd love to continue the conversation.
Well, thanks very much, Jess. And that's it. We run out of time. And I'm Joe Schwartz, hoping all the chemistry in your life comes out just right.